Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Now, it is the first Monday in March, and before the NBA season, it was pretty safe to assume that when we got to this point, there'd be one of two LA teams with the best record in the West. At the start of the season, I think most people, if they're being objective, would have said that. And the expectation was, of those two LA teams, it would be the Clippers. After all, they won nearly 50 games last season. They gave Golden State hell in the first round, and then they went out and they added Kawhi and Paul George. But they're not the ones who are sitting atop the West. Of course, it's the Lakers. The team that missed on Kawhi, the Lakers. The team that has not been to the postseason in 6 years, the Lakers. And the team that had been a complete mess last season. That team is sitting on top of the West. And while the Clippers were fighting off a legendary performance from Shake Milton and trying not to lose to a Sixers team without Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, the Lakers were playing without Anthony Davis and Alex Caruso, and they were coming off a really weird loss to Memphis. So if ever there was a time to question the Lakers, to wonder if maybe LeBron was running out of gas, then it would have been last night. But then LeBron goes out, and he drops 34 points, 13 assists, and 12 rebounds in a 122-114 win. So I said it last week, and I'm going to underline it right now. If the league is trying to make me won a Pelicans-Lakers first-round series, mission accomplished. Well done. In fact, I pretty much want that more than I want anything else out of my life right now. Because these last two games between these two teams haven't just lived up to the hype, they've smashed it completely. I mean, this is a blast. This is a lot of fun. Any game with Zion is a blast. Any game with LeBron is a blast. So any game with Zion and LeBron going at each other is incredible. Because what you get is LeBron going for a 34-point triple-double and Zion at 19 going for 35. And again, one guy is 35 and the other guy is only 19. And to me, I'm not even sure which one of those things impresses me more. Both those facts are utterly ridiculous, and they were going right at each other early on.
Williams on the low block, guarded by James, goes straight at him and finishes. Zion's 3 for 3, 6 points here in the first 4.5 minutes.
That's just cool. That's just one very large human being slammed into another very large human and then getting his. And then you had LeBron going right back at Zion.
James going at Zion, and LeBron wins that one.
LeBron putting on a dribbling clinic and blowing right by the rook. And then you had this utterly comical sequence in the second quarter.
James going at Zion, and LeBron wins that one.
Uh-oh. What we're talking about here is Zion destroying Kyle Kuzma and then nearly destroying the rim in the process. And then LeBron responding with a three from roughly a dribble inside half court. That was a shot LeBron had been working on before the game, and of course he went out there and he nailed it. It was awesome. Everything about that game was incredible. The Pelicans kept coming at the end, getting close, and then the Lakers would respond, and then LeBron stuck this in Zion's eye.
LeBron's got it on the right wing, one-on-one against Zion. Three-pointer by LeBron. It's good! LeBron for three! 116-111, 32 for the King.
Only thing missing from that was, dude, no. Yes, yes, LeBron, yes. There have been a lot of electric performances. I knew you had that one. Alvin, you did that game, right? Or was that just a Cavalier thing? I know you've been running that side hustle, and I haven't been able to keep up with it. Oh, I've got that coming up a little bit later on. Please stay, LeBron. Look, there have been a lot of electric performances from LeBron this season, but that's right near the top. They're now 8-0 in the second game of a back-to-back. They're 19-2 on the road against the West. And that's before we even get into LeBron's dishing last night, which was incredible. Ask Alvin Gentry, who still seemed to be in shock even after the game ended.
I'm just amazed that they talk about anybody other than him for MVP. You know, that's what he does. Every team that he's been to, every team that he's gone, have a chance to win the championship. So, you know, to me, I mean, I, I'm not sure what the definition of MVP is, but he makes everybody on his team better, and it makes it difficult for everybody playing.
That's pretty interesting. I mean, a couple of things when you hear that. A couple of things are clear. LeBron is, in fact, playing at an MVP level. Nobody can say he's not. So, number one, he is playing at an MVP level. Number two, he's not going to win the MVP. Not this year. Not because he doesn't deserve it, but because Giannis is also playing at an MVP level. In any other year, LeBron is running away with this thing. Except in this year, Giannis is averaging 30, 14, and 5 in less than 31 minutes per game on a team that's got a legitimate look at 70. No one else is getting that trophy. But that doesn't mean that LeBron does not deserve every bit of the run and credit he's getting right now, because he does. And so does Zion. Again, that's a 19-year-old who went into last night's game with 10 straight 20-point games. And then he goes for 35. No wonder LeBron was hyping him after the game. Quote, "You have to actually be out on the floor to actually feel the strength and the speed that he plays at. It's a hell of a rookie class, I'll tell you that. These kids are special," end quote. So it's no wonder that LeBron shared a moment with Zion after the game. Just don't ask LeBron what he said, because he's not telling you. And do not confuse LeBron showing respect with LeBron being soft.
You know, anybody that says that, you know, LeBron, why would he do that while he's playing? It's a show and sign of weakness. You know, he's buddy-buddy with the guys that he's going against. Tell me, kiss my ass. All right? With a smile, too.
Oh! Love it. Anybody who says that that's a sign of weakness or softness or him butting up, quote, kiss my ass with a smile, too. Man, I wish you would have tagged that with that guttural roar at the very end. Do them together, Albie. How would that sound? Kiss my ass with a smile, too. Oh!
Tell me, kiss my ass.
All right. Close enough, Albie. Look, this is not about the AAUification of the league, or the guys don't want to destroy each other on the court. Because there was absolutely nothing about how Zion and LeBron played last night that wasn't about destroying each other or the other team on the floor. You can compete like hell during the game and still hug it out after the game. It's not a sign of being soft or buddying up. It's a sign of respect. Don't confuse that kindness with weakness. And if you think that LeBron's getting weak or old, go back and watch the game tape. Watch him absolutely bully everybody who came at him in the post and pick apart the defense with passes and then shove daggers in the eye of anybody on the perimeter. What LeBron was doing was showing respect to a young star, but he's letting that young star know it's not your time yet. I'm still here. LeBron is still here. And I go back to a point that I made earlier. I'm not sure at this point, when I look at LeBron at 35 and Zion at 19, I'm not sure who impresses me more, Zion or LeBron. Both were equally ridiculous to me last night. He is Jason Lockenfora. JLC, what's going on? How are you?
I'm doing well. Anytime you're flirting with the Utz girl on Twitter, you're doing all right.
Dude, that's
someone from the Mid-Atlantic region. That's right up there with Mr. Bo from Natty Bohemian Beer. That's a legendary mascot.
I was going to ask you, and I will ask you about the new project you're working, but man, to get a shout out from Utz Snacks. In fact, how good is your life right now?
Dude, not much that I do resonates with my kids, but when I showed them when Utz responded to me following them, that I got some cachet around my house for the first time, like probably ever.
I love it. All right, so before we get to the combine, you are going to co-host Inside Access on 105.7 The Fan in Baltimore. It's going to be weekdays from 2 until 6 p.m. It really is huge. How did that come to be, and how hyped are you for the opportunity?
I am totally amped. I just left the office of our program director here at the station to come on with you. We're in some planning meetings. I mean, I've grown to love this format really all of my life, and grew up listening to sports talk nationally and at home in Baltimore. Have been lucky enough to be able to absorb stuff from people like you by coming on as a guest for years, and I can't wait to get started.
Are you craving some protein after a good workout? Then don't make a shake. Don't eat a bar. Instead, grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Why Old Trapper? Because Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and it's tender. It's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. Old Trapper is a family-owned business that takes smoked beef extremely seriously, and you can taste it in every bite. I mean, who wants dried, tough beef in a bag? Nobody. It's like eating a shoe. Old Trapper, though, is the real deal, and it comes in four amazing flavors. Old Fashioned is sweetened with a touch of brown sugar goodness, teriyaki, peppered, and hot and spicy for those of you who like to take things up a notch. So, the next time you want a great protein, an energy snack that you can have anytime, anywhere, grab some Old Trapper beef jerky. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. That way you can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Jason, I'm thrilled for you, man. You earned that. You're going to kill it. I know you will, and I'm really happy for you. Congrats on that.
Thank you.
Now, you had a great piece on CBSSports.com about what was said by teams at the Combine and what they actually mean by it, starting with Raiders GM Mike Mayock talking about Derek Carr and his future. What was Mayock really saying there as it relates to Carr and potentially Tom Brady?
I think he was sending a message to the rest of the league that, hey, if you think Derek Carr is better than your current quarterback and you're interested, hit us up because we're kind of still dating this guy. We're not, you may have thought we put a ring on his finger, but not really. And we're looking to upgrade, and maybe it's Tom Brady or maybe it's Tua Tagovailoa. We're sorting through some stuff here, but if Derek Carr floats your boat, we might be able to work something out.
Jason Lockin for him, my guest. All right, then what about Bruce Arians? He said this of Jameis Winston, quote, you don't know what trades might happen. You don't know who is behind door number two yet. Then you can make a decision, end of quote. Can you decode that for me? What is he actually saying?
Yeah, he's saying, Phillip Rivers, are you going to cost us $60 million for two, or is it going to be more like the Nick Foles $50 million for two? Because we think Jameis is going to cost us around 30 a year. And so are we going to put that non-exclusive tag on him at 27 because you're either going to pick the Colts over us or we're not cool with your price point. But I mean, that's door number two. I believe at the end of the day that the Bucks, if they don't have two tags, obviously that'll make life more difficult and we'll see what comes of the collective bargaining situation, but they're not letting Shaq Barrett go. So he will be tagged at all costs. If they don't have two tags, can they work something out with Jameis? I don't know that they're going to be able to upgrade from Jameis when you go through all the different permutations, but certainly they would look at Phillip Rivers as somebody they'd have big interest in. But I think the Colts might end up being the best spot for Phillip.
We're talking to Jason Lockenfora. All right, so over the weekend, there were also reports, JLC, suggesting that Washington is interested in Tua with the number two pick overall. Do you really think they're serious about that, or are they trying to get Miami to trade up from five to get him?
Well, I think when you have the second pick in the draft and there are two quarterbacks who are both looked at as having the talent to be worthy of the first overall pick in the draft, you have to do your due diligence. There's no reason why you wouldn't spend time with them, no reason why you wouldn't check out their pro days, no reason why you wouldn't allow Tua to absolutely wow you. But there's also something to be gained from doing all that to the outside world, which is, hey, Miami and anybody else who thinks you might be able to stay at five or six or seven or whatever, or you think you only have to move up to, you know, maybe three or four to jump Miami. Well, guess what? What if we take this kid? And then we could just have an auction. We could see what we could get for Tua. We could see what we could get for Haskins. What makes the most sense for us? I think they want to find out as soon as possible what's the biggest haul we could get for the second overall pick. And more likely that means them coming off of Chase Young than it does Tua. I'm not sure that they would go that route at the end of the day if they stayed at two. But I talk to a lot of other teams who, when they assess the Redskins situation, they think it's screaming out for a trade down, even as good as Chase Young may be. Unless he's Lawrence Taylor, if you pull off a reverse RG3 trade, them going down rather than moving up for a quarterback, you could be looking at 3 1s, 2 2s, and a 3. That fills a lot of holes.
Jason Lockenfora joining us in the jungle once again. Now, you also have a piece up today breaking down what each team should do in the coming weeks, and the priority you have for the Patriots is to sign Marcus Mariota. What do you like about that fit for him and for them?
I mean, sometimes a change of scenery does you a lot of good. There's such a winning culture up there. You know, Marcus isn't a big rah-rah guy. He's not going to say a ton. He's kind of a low-key, lead-by-example guy. He has a skill set. It hasn't been fully tapped into. And look, he the injuries and all that, maybe he'll never come anywhere close to being what people hope. But I think Josh McDaniels could mold a little clay there. I think mentally he's the kind of kid who could handle having to be the guy who replaced TB12, if that's the case. And then, look, if Tom Brady does come back, it's year to year, they find a package for Mariota. They find a way to develop him, and maybe 1 year working with Josh in practice would be the best thing for him. I mean, Teddy Bridgewater hit the reset button on his career in a big way and might be better for it. So whether it's, you know, Mariota, whether it's Andy Dalton, whether it's Cam Newton, I certainly think, well, I know for a fact that the Patriots are putting contingencies together, because they are nothing close to a guarantee that Tom Brady will be back in Foxborough.
Jason Locken for NFL Insider for CBS Sports, CBSSports.com as well. He's got a new radio program starting up. So what about TB12? We're at the beginning of March right now, Jason. What is your sense as to how things are going to play out for Brady?
I know that some people kind of writing off the Patriots. I think that's a little misguided. The Patriots are going to lay out and let this thing develop and give the time and space he needs to figure out for the first time in his life what his true market value is. And the way you ascertain that is your agent, you know, starts sending out feelers and starts having exploratory phone calls. And you start getting a feel for how strong, you know, a couple of owners may come and how they're going to pursue him. And are those situations more conducive to me winning right bleeping now than the one in New England, where they need a whole lot more on the offensive side of the ball than just a quarterback? So that is beginning. And Don Yee, his agent, was in Indianapolis for a couple of days last week. And Don Yee avoids Indianapolis at all costs in February. He was there because his generational client is doing something he's never done before, diving into the deep end of free agency. I still think at the end of the day, there's 3 to 4 other teams and the Patriots who really are in this thing in terms of making contract offers and trying to win this auction. But Robert Kraft will have his say. Whether it's enough, I don't know that anybody knows, but he will be a part of the process at the appropriate time.
JLC joining us for a few more moments. There was also, Jason, a report over the weekend that the Chicago Bears were looking to bring in a veteran quarterback to push Mitch Trubisky. If that's the case, do you think that might be Andy Dalton? If not Dalton, then who?
Yeah, look, I've been reporting on their interest in Andy Dalton for quite some time, really since they hired Bill Lazor as their offensive coordinator. Bill Lazor and Andy Dalton did really good things together in Cincinnati. Andy Dalton is very heady and cerebral. He would be the embodiment of that system. He already speaks the language. He has a pretty good resume. And did they get it done in the playoffs? No, but you know, he was a part of some Bengals teams that reached the playoffs 5 straight times. He wasn't in all of them, but nevertheless, when he had some talent around him, he was a functional, winning NFL starting quarterback. Mitch Trubisky has not proven to be anything close to that. So I think Dalton will end up being the guy there. You know, could that be a spot for Mariota? There's other options for sure, but I got a feeling Andy Dalton ends up with the Bears.
So if he does, can we assume that ultimately he's going to win that job and be QB1 there?
Yeah, and I don't even know if it takes as long as the Mariota Tannehill thing took last year to develop. I think it would be really obvious, you know, even if it's a truncated preseason, and I think we'll still have a normal one this year, but even in a shortened preseason, I think it'd be real clear, real fast, who the better quarterback was.
Jason Lockenforo for a couple of more moments. One of the suggestions you also have is that the Titans should let Derrick Henry see what he can get on the open market. Lay that out for me. Why do you say that?
I just think with running backs, and especially running backs who are as big and physical as he is, and running backs who, while he can catch a screen pass and go rumbling down the sidelines, he's not a guy who's going to win for you in the passing game as often as a Christian McCaffrey, type back would. Boy, you're talking about you know, a guy who's going to want, and understandably so, his $14 or $15 million a year like a Le'Veon Bell got. But you start looking at that team, all the mouths they have to feed. They got to try to keep that offensive line together. You know, can they keep Conklin, their right tackle? They're in a little bit of a jackpot with Tannehill, and yeah, they've got interest in Tom Brady too. But you know, what if you move, you know, lose out? And do you really see Tom Brady in Nashville? I mean, maybe. They've got a lot going on, Jim, and I don't know that I'm going to necessarily make my off-season priority built around being able to keep that running back. As good as he is, I just don't know who goes out there and absolutely, you know, blows the market up to pay him. You know, letting him see what else is out there and then working something out, maybe even a short-term 2 or 3 year deal, might be the best course of action. But if we're talking about tags and who you can absolutely secure and who you can't, I'd be more worried about the quarterback and the right tackle.
All right, as great as this conversation is, there's no way I let you go without one question about the Cowboys. Pretty clear Dallas is going to tag Dak Prescott. What do you expect to see happen between the Cowboys and Amari Cooper then?
Yeah, I mean, do they get to apply the second tag or not? And how quickly do the players vote on this new CBA, and do they get all that ironed out, you know, before the start of the league year? No one knows. If they have a second tag, they'll absolutely put it on Amari Cooper. If they don't, there's no excuse to lose him. I mean, I don't want to hear about salary cap. I don't want to hear about, you know, what's, oh, well, they got to pay Dak and blah, 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 blah. Nobody has revenue streams like the Dallas Cowboys. And, you know, no, he hasn't spent big there, Jerry, in a while. And you look at his actual cost for payroll the last 5-7 years, they're not up there with the biggest spenders in the league. So, you know, you've got this gambling money about to pour in. You've got new TV contracts on the horizon. You've got his old quarterback doing real well as well. I don't want to hear Jerry Jones can't pay Amari Cooper. If he has to go out in the market, give him one penny more than anybody else will, and you'll be able to keep him. Cash over cap. You can always figure out a way to lower somebody's cap number. So there should be no excuses. They're going to lose Byron Jones, and I think that's a significant loss. But there should be no excuses not to be able to keep your quarterback and your wide receiver, especially when you're the Dallas Cowboys.
Jason, in season, you actually do a really good job of getting out to see an occasional show if you can, especially if you're in New York, as long as it doesn't interfere. I'm curious, what's the summer concert viewing tour look like? Are you seeing shows in and around the area? Can you travel to a show? What are you looking at?
You know, I saw Refused in D.C. Last week. That was awesome. I'm going to see Bikini Kill in Philadelphia in May. I think I'm going to see Cheap Trick in D.C. this spring.
But
I haven't looked too deep into the summer yet, Jim. So if you have and you know you're in your buddies at Live Nation, see anything that meets my eclectic palate, you know I'm always game for it. And I think I built up enough goodwill here at the radio station. If I had to cut out a little early to get up to New York for a show, they might let me.
Yeah, I'm asking you because I was looking for some ideas and advice myself, but I gotta admit, Cheap Trick is pretty intriguing. I like that. I like the way that sounds.
Yeah, they put on a great show. I've seen them many times, and those guys are legit.
I have never seen them live. I do bump them when I work out. Jason Lockenfora, NFL insider for CBS Sports, CBSSports.com. JLC, sorry to pull you out of that meeting because you got yourself a new project. Co-host of Inside Access on 105.7 The Fan in Baltimore. Congrats on that, and congrats on the enormous shout-out from Utz Snacks, JLC.
Thank you, and we got to get you on the show, brother. We'll flip the script. I'd love to be on the other side.
You got it. Done. I am ready to make an official statement. I wanted to wait. I wanted to lay out, but I am now prepared to make an official statement about that league. And that statement is, the jury is still out. I mean, there really are no testing the theory, or I should say they really are testing the theory about there's no such thing as bad pizza, bad sex, bad football. Because let's face it, the football with the XFL is not good football. Far from the best football I've ever seen. You know it's a bad sign, for instance, when some of the league's best moments, some of the league's best highlights involve guys F-bombing the camera and throwing flags back at the officials. And yes, those things did happen over the weekend. The second thing especially happened in the New York Guardians LA Wildcats game. In case you missed it, you probably did. I'll roll it for you.
Over Jordan Smallwood, a flag comes in, and Drayvon Askew Henry is wondering why. Usually it's just the officials who are throwing flags. See what Askew Henry does with that penalty marker.
After the play, unsportsmanlike conduct, throwing the flag at an official, number 29 of the defense. That penalty is also enforced. First down.
Why the hell not? An official throws a flag at you. What are you going to do? You're going to throw it right back at him. It was great. Well, maybe not great, but at least it was something to talk about. At least it was something to remember in an otherwise forgettable game between the Guardians and the Wildcats. And if you love that matchup between two totally generic teams, you're really going to like the Dallas Renegades and the Houston Roughnecks. Those team names are so bad, they'd be better off going without team names. Just go with Dallas and Houston. Except the mascots weren't even the worst part of that game. Ask Dallas quarterback Landry Jones. And then when you're done asking him, ask his head coach, Bob Stoops. And then ask Bob why he has anything at all to do with any of this. I still can't figure that out. That's beside the point, though, because Landry Jones had a rough one against the Roughnecks. Maybe the roughest one ever. Before we get into the game itself, let me just remind you that Landry Jones was glossed by ESPN as, quote, the face of the XFL before the season started. And the face of the XFL had a brutal day, starting on that first Dallas possession. First and 10, inside the Houston 40, Jones drops back and does his job. He finds a man wide open. Unfortunately, that man was wearing a Houston jersey. Roll it.
Fifth play of the drive. Jones has time, firing down the middle, and it's intercepted. Cody Brown has the interception with some blockers. Now to midfield, and Cody Brown, his second interception of the year.
That was bad. That was really bad, and it was about to get much worse because Jones was only getting started. He put gas in that turnover machine on the first drive, but he really opened up the engine on the second drive.
So on first down, blitz coming, quick throw, tip, and it's intercepted again. Dietrich Nichols has it, and another big return. The sixth interception of the year already by Landry Jones, and two in this game.
Landry, are you kidding me? Landry, that is the Houston Roughnecks defense that you're facing. You do not throw into coverage like that against the Houston Roughnecks. The hell I need to tell you that? That defense has been legendary, an iconic defense since the inception of that league 5 minutes ago. How bad was that second pick? Don't ask me. Check instead with Dallas head coach Bob Stoops.
No. Oh, my gosh. Well, I don't know why he's throwing it. The guy's all over him.
How about that? No. Oh, my gosh. You run that back? Run that back and see if you can hear the moment that the enthusiasm and hope and Lee and life leaves Bob Stoops altogether.
No. Oh, my gosh. Well, I don't know why he's throwing it. The guy's all over him.
I think it happened somewhere between the oh my gosh and the I don't know why he would throw it. The guy's all over him. And notice also there's no headset throwing. There's no emphatic, why would you ponder passing?
Why do you even ponder passing?
Not even a, what am I doing here in the XFL? Just resignation. Oh, but it was going to get worse. It was about to get even worse. Two interceptions on the first two drives, and the only question was, could my man complete the hat trick? Could he get three INTs on the first three drives? And you know what? I'm going to spare you the expense. The answer is yes, he got the hat trick, the three-peat. Yeah, I know. Enormous spoiler alert. But honestly, if you have an XFL game on your DVR and you haven't watched it yet and you're upset by what I just told you, that's on you, not on me. That's a you problem, not a me problem. And at that point in the game, the Dallas Renegades had a major quarterback problem. And fortunately, they got some free advice courtesy of Houston defensive back Charles James II.
Get Landry Jones the f*** out of here.
Get Landry Jones the bleep out of here.
Get Landry Jones the f*** out of here.
It, like I said, it's a concern when your best highlights are a player throwing a flag back at the official, and guys F-bombing other guys. But that was one of the highlights of the weekend, you got to admit.
Get Landry Jones the out of here.
Get Landry Jones the bleep out of here.
Get Landry Jones the out of here.
I got to tell you, I've got no idea who Charles James II is, but I do know he's my favorite XFLer of all time. And if that's the way he handles his business, I have to meet Charles James I. Get Landry Jones the bleep out of here.
Get Landry Jones the out of here.
You think he'd want him to stay in the game, right? But Jones did not get the bleep out of here. Not then. He stayed in and somehow managed to fumble two drives later, giving him a grand slam of turnovers in the first half alone. And although he didn't say it again on camera, I guarantee my man was thinking, get Landry Jones the bleep out of here.
Get Landry Jones the f*** out of here.
Only the XFL would mic guys like that so they could drop F-bombs, mocking the opposition. It's a good thing they do. Why else would we watch? And yet, even more amazing than the four turnovers in the first half is the fact that Dallas was only trailing by 1 point going into the fourth quarter. Yeah, I know. Get the bleep out of here with that. It's true. Four turnovers in the first, and they were only down a point going into the fourth. Then they lost Jones to a knee injury on a quarterback sneak. And I got to be honest, all clowning aside, I actually hate that for that guy. I mean, I really do. Having a bad day is one thing. It's going to happen all the time on every level. You can grow from it, maybe laugh at it. But having that bad of a day include an injury is so much worse. And things aren't so cool and so fun then. And it's a reminder, even though that's a league with generic team names and generic football, there are real players who can suffer real injuries in games that really do not matter, except to James Kelly. And that sucks. Those are real players suffering real injuries in games that really don't matter. So again, I still can't give you my final judgment on that league. It's not a big enough viewing sample. But seeing Jones throw a ton of picks didn't make me love that league. And then seeing him get injured made me like it even less. However, Charles James II is definitely my dude now. Whoever the hell he is.
Get Landry Jones the f*** out of here.
Definitely one of the highlights of the weekend. I don't know if that's a comment on me or them or both.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh, Bob. And like, I'm not really sure. Like, I know Bob loves the game and I know he loves coaching and probably had a Jones to compete. But like, for all the opportunities that guy's had, why is that the one he said yes to? Like, oh my gosh, Bob. How much money can be in that?
Oh my gosh.
Not enough to see his quarterback go over there and turn it over four times in the first half and then get hurt.
No.
Yes. He is Matt Norlander. Matt, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. Thanks for that intro. And for anyone who is super, super into March, do check out that Ion College Basketball podcast because the latest version, listen, it's not quite on the Alvin DeLauro level, but Jim, I swear to you, it's really, really close. Some good drops of some March Madness highlights.
I love it.
So
love
if you're into it, go find it.
Get there. Be there. Nothing is on Alvin's level. I know that you know that, Matt. All right, so you were in College Park on Saturday night, which was the 29th day of February. In most other years, that would make it the first day of March, which is Tom Izzo's month. Knowing that, were you at all surprised by how Michigan State showed up and handled number 9 Maryland?
Yes, I was, because I picked Maryland to win the game on CBSSports.com. I won't run from that. It was an impressive showing out of Michigan State. Now, Maryland has looked like the best team in the Big Ten for the majority of the season. That was the first loss Maryland took at home this season, and the Terps haven't actually gone wire to wire without an L in their own building since Gary Williams was running it back with his guys in 2002 when they won the national championship. So, shouts to Lonnie Baxter. So, I was a little bit surprised by that, but this is Michigan State, the preseason number one team, overwhelmingly back in October. And in the fact that they've lost this many games, it was something I talked to with Cassius Winston, Xavier Tillman, and they said, we think that we really are better than what our record showed. And what Tom Izzo told me afterward that I found a little surprising was, he said after they lost to Maryland 2 weeks ago, he went home in some self-loathing, put on the video in his office, was up till after 4 a.m., and started looking at all their losses and really determined that, you know, with 2 minutes to go and almost every single loss they've had, they were in the game. It was a one possession game. So he had to kind of convince his guys, like, we really are better than what our record's shown here. And this is why. They bought in. They're on a 3-game win streak, and they could wind up, it would actually be perfect, I guess. Like, if Michigan State winds up being a 4 seed, if they can play onto that, that would mean they would go and probably be in the region where they'd go to Indianapolis if they made the second weekend, Jim. And if that was the case and Kansas got through, Kansas would be the one. And so then you'd have to pick, like, you know, am I going to take Bill Self and the Jayhawks? They look like the best team. Or could the preseason number one team actually be the team to beat the Jayhawks? So just a little bit of an NCAA tournament preview down the road there if they can get it going. But it was impressive, a great environment there at the Xfinity Center. Those Maryland fans were definitely into it, and they got a really, really good team as well. It's certainly capable of getting the Final Four, just like Sparty.
Matt Norlander joining us. All right, back to the Jayhawks. Kansas is the number one team in the country following their win over Baylor on February 22nd. You were at that game. Is Kansas the best team in college basketball in your mind?
Oh, yeah. In my mind, in the voters' minds, in the metrics, if they are self-aware of those minds as well, Kansas is the universal number one team in college basketball. So the selection committee, as some people may realize, they have 6 different metrics they go off of. We hear about the net most commonly because that is the NCAA's official sorting tool, if you will. But all of those metrics, net, KPI, KenPom, strength of record, BPI, Sagarin, all of them have Kansas at 1, and it's been that way for a while. And I'd say the gap even widened here because Baylor, unfortunately, got the Norlander jinx and not only lost that game, has since lost at TCU. Still a 1 seed, Scott Drew's Bears, and having a really, really nice season. But it is Kansas and everyone else. And I think the biggest reason why, and it's why I really enjoy watching the Jayhawks, is that they've got a player that has no close parallel in the entire sport. Like, Udoka Azubuike is a beast, and he has gotten progressively better. See, if you look across the past 15 years of college basketball, there have not been a lot of big men, true centers, who have each year noticeably got, you know, a lot better. That used to be the common thing in the 60s, 70s, 80s, even in the 90s, but that breed, I mean, it has kind of gone the way of the dodo mostly, but it's not the case with Azubuike. So you pair him with one of the fastest guys in the sport, and Devon Dotson, and that's why Kansas is, you know, an overwhelming favorite for number one. And just to link it back to Michigan State, though, that's why the Spartans with Cassius Winston and Xavier Tillman, you know, Xavier Tillman's, he might become the 3rd player in like 30 years to average 13 points, 10 boards, 3 assists, and 2 blocks. The only guys other to do that were Tim Duncan, and I'm going to drop a Bo Outlaw reference on the
show. Oh, I love
right
it.
Now. So you weren't ready for it, but there it is. And so that's why those teams in particular, when they've got good point guard and big man play, they've got a really good chance of going deep in the tournament.
I was ready, Matt. Every day I hope that somebody drops a Bo Outlaw reference on me, and it finally happened. I love Bo Outlaw. Matt Norlander, my guest. Let's talk some West Coast basketball. What do you make of the job that Mick Cronin's done? Now, remember, UCLA started the year 8-9. That included losses to Hofstra and Cal State Fullerton. They have gone 11-2 since. What has happened to them, and what do you make of the job Mick's done?
It's unbelievable. I was talking with Mick and his staff back in December when things were just, you know, first season, how is this going to go? A little bit tricky to say the least. This was even before the Cal State Fullerton loss, and they couldn't say who the best player was. They had a lot of pieces they needed to figure out, and when you're losing to the Cal State Fullerton, you know, that's a problem, a significant one. It's not like UC Santa Barbara. Okay, we're talking Fullerton here. You know what I'm saying? And so since then, they have been able to get right because Cody Riley's been terrific. Tiger Campbell is a playmaking lead guard who's been pretty good. And Jaime Jaquez, the freshman who actually hit the 3 to beat Arizona State back on Thursday, they've gotten it right. But if you look statistically, so UCLA, it's just an incredible story. I don't know if we've had a team, Jim, in the past 10 to 15 years that has had an in-season turnaround that has been this big of a swing. We're talking about UCLA going from being 8-9, 1-3 in the league to now 19-11, 12-5 in the Pac-12, leading the Pac-12 technically by a half game as we speak here today on Monday, and are tracking toward the NCAA tournament. They've got a bizarre profile. Those metrics I mentioned just a couple of minutes ago, none of them place UCLA as high, like, you know, in the 30s, the 40s, even the 50s overall in the sport. So that doesn't suggest an at-large profile, but the wins at this point are kind of undeniable, and the fact that they're ahead in the Pac-12 is amazing. Only 1 game left, They play at USC on Saturday. That's an intriguing bubble game. Neither of those two teams are for sure in. I think UCLA's got to win that and then pick off a couple more in the Pac-12, and then it can get in. And that would just be – that'd be an incredible incredible story for UCLA, obviously, for the city. It wants to see UCLA be more relevant, and certainly that's something to keep an eye on there. And Jalen Hill has not been an insignificant part of that. Real quick on him, I did a story about a month ago on, 12, 13 players in D1 who wear 24 because of Kobe Bryant. Jalen Hill happened to be one of them. He is from Los Angeles, certainly was a highly regarded recruit. And so, this is turning into a pretty special story in L.A. out there in college hoops.
So one more thought then, Matt, because you mentioned my alma mater, UC Santa Barbara, and you mentioned Kobe. I was at UC Irvine on Saturday night for that Gaucho Anteater game for two reasons. One, I had to represent the Gaucho family. I wanted to see my folks. And I also wanted to see somebody that you wrote a great piece on, Ryan Battertelli. He's somebody I know, and I've never discussed him on the show before, but I do know him, and I wanted to go see him and have a few moments with him. You wrote a great piece on him. He's a UC Irvine assistant coach who was very, very close to Kobe Bryant, and that's how I knew Ryan. How did their connection first start?
Yeah, I'll try and be quick with this. This wound up becoming a story that I got a lot more response to than I even anticipated here, but that's the power of Kobe Bryant. But back when Ryan was not even assistant, he was Adobo, a director of basketball operations, and making $17,000 a year. Kobe lived near UCI, and so he was looking to just get a place to get some good local run in where he could literally drive 10 minutes away because obviously, the Lakers facilities were much further. And so one of the people representing Kobe and the Lakers called Irvine and said, listen, we're thinking about maybe this being a thing. No one really took it seriously enough. And so it just kind of got put into Ryan's lap because he was the grunt guy. It's like, listen, we don't know if this is a thing, but take it just in case. And, fast forward, it was a thing. Kobe went there. It's just amazing to me that at that point, UCI had not made an NCAA tournament. It wasn't a big time low major program, but it was good enough for Kobe Bryant, and Ryan became an assistant coach, and he just was simply monitoring things as Kobe was getting shots up, and then he was like, hey, I thought you were a basketball coach. Are you just going to sit there in the bleachers and just, no, you need to get on the floor right now and help me. And so he did, and soon enough, he became one of Kobe's trainers, strength and conditioning coach, and he didn't share this for basically more than a decade. A few people realized it, but no one really realized how close he was. Kobe Bryant, the height of his career came after he met Ryan Battertelli, and he won his only MVP. He got the Lakers to those two more championships in 2009, 2010. He won a gold medal. When Kobe went over to Germany and that became a story, Ryan was the guy that was over there with him. And there's a lot of details in the story, including Kobe insisting that Ryan, be on the parade route, go into the Coliseum after they won the finals, wanting to give him a finals ring, and Ryan refusing to take it. And then, Kobe retires, and he brings him into the office. Ryan doesn't know what's going on, and he says, listen, I know you didn't want to take this 6-7 years ago, but I don't win this without your help. And here it is, and there's photos of it in the story, and it's got Ryan's name on it, Lakers championship. So it's really incredible that one of the most influential trainers in Kobe's life just happened to be this fairly anonymous Big West assistant coach. And in light of the tragedy with Kobe and his daughter and the seven others on that helicopter, Ryan was willing to speak out on that for the first time. And yeah, very powerful story. And as I know you well know, but certainly a tragic thing. But nonetheless, it shed a light on more of who Kobe was and how he was willing to work hard and help
Matt,
other people.
There's a lot in that story that I did not know. I did not know the ring story, which is amazing. And the first time I met Ryan, Kobe hits me up and he says, yo, fam, let's go to Javier's. I'm like, sure. When? Where? He's like, 9:00. I'm like, I'm there. And Ryan's there, and I'd never met Ryan, and I didn't know Ryan. And you're right. There was I don't want to say there was a secrecy or a confidentiality to it, but the fact that he was with Kobe told me everything that I needed to know about how strongly Kobe felt about Ryan, how much he respected him, and how much Kobe just would not roll with somebody like that if he didn't have the highest regard for him.
Right, and Ryan did actually bring up, in the course of my interview with him, he brought up going to Javier's with Kobe, and it was one of those things where he saw, kind of how Kobe lived his life on a day-to-day basis, and who was there, who was in his orbit, who would come into his orbit and then leave, and so he wasn't going to jeopardize Kobe in any kind of way. So he just simply did not broadcast it, to the point where he would just be with Kobe in public and people would assume that he was his bodyguard. He wasn't, but he would kind of take that role on. But he had some amazing stories. Like, he just would go out with Kobe and then, oh, by the way, yeah, we're going to go meet David. Oh, okay, cool. Who's David? Oh, yeah, it's going to be you, me, and David Beckham. We're going to sit here at a dinner. It's just he was very close to Kobe, and it was just, you know, an example of how if you do things the right way, you put in the work, you put in the effort, you know, you can develop these unexpected relationships in your life. And I know you were certainly someone that knew Kobe well and would occasionally meet up, as you said, with him at the legendary Javier's. But it was a powerful story, and for him personally, you know, it was helpful for him to be able to grieve a little more openly, because Kobe Bryant went to UCI. We're talking about a guy that would, you know, hop in the ice bath and there would be members of the men's soccer team next to him, you know, and he was able to have still that level of privacy, but a level of comfort there with UCI. And I don't think a lot of people outside of that tight knit community geographically really knew that.
I don't think, Matt, that a lot of people inside of that tight knit community really knew that. Like I mentioned when he passed, Matt, that it was so troubling, and it's still so hard to grasp, because Kobe was so visible in the community. We would all see him around all the time, driving around with his kids, at In-N-Out, at Javier's, and he was so approachable and so accessible. But I'm not sure a lot of people around here really knew the relationship he had with that school. The piece is amazing. You should all go and find it and read it. It's really a great piece. He covers college basketball for CBSSports.com. He's the co-host of CBS Sports Ion College Basketball Podcast. Look for that. Matt Norlander, my guest. Great job, Matt. Really well done. Thanks so much for it.
I appreciate it, man. Keep up the good work with the Daily Jungle stuff. That story about the clone with the Disturbed concert and the kidney donation, I was listening to that at the gym recently, and that was just you talk about unbelievable stories. That was a good one. So shouts to Hawk as well. Jim, I appreciate it. The best month of the year is here, and can't wait for the tournament starting here in 2 weeks. Thank you so much.
Atlanta star Trae Young. He's done nothing but impress players, coaches, and fans, and aggregate a few, but mostly impress everybody with the way he plays the game. Hell, even at Oklahoma, this guy had lots of fans. I remember former legend, well, actually, he is a legend, former standout, my man Kenny Anderson, tweeted me about how much he loved this guy when we had him on the show. Kenny Anderson. So Trey's got fans, lots of fans, and there's a reason for it. It's his style of play. He has range, he has handles, and while Atlanta's going through a rebuild around the young point guard, Trae is always, in and of himself, worth the price of admission. Few point guards fill up the stat sheet and get the kind of online run that my man Trae does. Nutmegs, long shots, trending every time this guy suits up. His game actually is perfect for today's younger generation of fans. Highlight after highlight after highlight of him embarrassing dudes. And he's totally unapologetic for it. And everybody gets the same treatment. And everybody, including me, loves him for it. Except there is one dude who's not about that life and not about being part of that highlight package. And that one dude is another guy that I have immense respect for, Trevor Ariza. Trevor's not only not about that life, he's not about that funny game. Trevor don't play that funny game. The Blazers forward is an old school dude. So what happens when the young stud meets the proud vet on Saturday night and they're already up 16? You know, young stud ain't backing down. And he tries to make him a part of the nightly Twitter nutmeg package. Why? Because the old stud is standing right in front of him. So Trae tried to do what Trae does. Roll it.
Batted away in Atlanta on the run. Here comes Trae Young.
Oh, now he's trying to clown. See, Trevor not having it. Trevor
trying to put the dribble between the wickets of Ariza, who stood him up and fouled him hard.
Yeah. He tries to throw it right between his legs, which he's done to a lot of people this year. Trevor not playing it. Trevor will take the foul and the tech and whatever else before he's going to let you do that.
Yeah, they're going to take a look and talk about flagrant.
So awesome. That was great. Trevor ain't having any of that clown stuff, bro. Forearm shiver. So Trae, and I love Trae got his nightly trend, just not the one he was looking for. And Trevor knew it was coming and was ready. There were some great games and some awesome highlights around the association this weekend, but I'm not sure there was much better than that play. Take away the Pelicans and Lakers, which I hit on earlier. I love that. That is so good. That's like, yeah, my man, don't try that silly stuff around here or you're going to get some. And for those who still are unaware of what a nutmeg is, I'm pretty sure you can figure it out. What you don't have to figure out was Trevor's intent, because my guy was not having any of that. He was assessed a flagrant one and could not care less. Ariza told a bunch of reporters when he pulled Young aside after the game, because he did pull him aside after the game. He physically pulled him aside after the game. Physically. And he said to the 21-year-old reportedly, quote, "Don't do that bleep again. At least not to me. I'm not with the funnies. I don't like the funnies." End quote. I mean, I don't know what's better. The actual forearm shiver or the quote afterwards explaining how he felt about it. "I'm not with the funnies." My man don't like the funnies. But Jim Rome does. Especially that funny. Because that was the funniest and best moment of the weekend. Trevor Ariza is not down with your nutmeg game, Trey. But I love that Trey's not backing down, ever. Even after that forearm shiver to the trachea. Man, who cares about the game? You try and put that ball between my legs, you're going to get some. Nothing better than a young, confident star taking the league by storm and feeding everybody the goods nightly. Except for when a proud vet meets that bravado with a forearm shiver. AJ Styles would have been impressed with your forearm game, Trevor. One of the best highlights of the weekend from a couple of dudes who will not back down and will not change. And I love it. Keep doing you, both of you. Except Trey, maybe you pass the next time. You have a shot to nutmeg Trev. If not, you're going to be wearing it again. That was an awesome moment.
Trevor not having it.
Trevor not having it at all. Trevor not having it.
Trevor not playing it.
Trevor not playing it. Trevor, not about that life. Tori Lavello is my guest. Tori, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing good, Romy. Always a pleasure. How are you doing?
Doing great, Tori. It's so good to hear your voice. Yeah. So we're about a week into Cactus League games. Mm-hmm. Before we get to camp, I got to ask, what was your offseason like? Did you get to unplug? Did you relax a little bit? What did you do?
Yeah, I mean, that's always what you're searching for. The season does get long and grinding. So it's just about the family, the friends, maybe a couple trips here and there to decompress. So I think once you start hitting that Christmas time, you start to really get excited about what's going to be happening over the course of the next several weeks as you form your team. So the new year downhill, even though it's a longer runway, you know that spring training is upon you, but it was a good off season for me where I recharge the batteries and I'm ready to roll.
Good to hear it. Tori Lavello, my guest. Now, from the outside, it sure seems like you had a team that finished second in the NL West and then made a number of moves to get even better this season. I know it's really, really early, but are you starting to get a sense as to the identity of this group?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because we still got to find this team chemistry. We just got to find where things happen the right way and plug into this culture day by day. And we have a really strong group where this culture is already deeply rooted inside of this clubhouse, and now it's about passing along to some of the newcomers. But we didn't win 85 games last year, and I think we caught a lot of people by surprise, but ourselves. We knew that we were very capable, and we played together as a team, and that's one of my demands. I believe in creating a family atmosphere, making sure that these guys pull for one another on the good and the bad days. That's where you really find the true test of character. And that's happening day by day right now. And we made some incredible additions. Our front office is off the charts with making us better every step of the way. We know we have a good ball club, but you don't play the game on a piece of paper. We got to go out. We got to execute. We're doing the heavy lifting part of getting these concepts to these guys right now through the spring. And it's what matters most. We want to make sure that when the season starts, we're ready to roll.
Tori Lavello is joining us. And Tori, Zach Gallen pitched yesterday. He's only 24. He's coming off a season where he made 15 starts. He had an ERA of 2.81. What did you make of what you saw from him after he came over in the trade with Miami, and how bright is his future?
Yeah, it's limitless. And I'm super excited that we were able to get him into this organization. He's a great student of the game. He wants to learn and get better, and that's always a good starting point for me. He's engaged with his coaches. He's trusting of the information he's getting, and then he goes out there and applies it. The stuff that he has is unbelievable. It's electric stuff that just explodes out of his hands and takes off in different areas in different ways. And he knows how to attack hitters. So, you know, the outings that we saw last year, although at times they could have been a little inconsistent, we knew from a young pitcher standpoint he was exactly where he wanted to be, was exactly where we thought he should be, and he's going to improve, and we want to see what he can do. The sky's the limit for him. We feel like potentially he's a guy that could win a Cy Young and win 20 games. That's the type of stuff he has. But that's on us to make sure that we're getting that across to him and teaching him the right way, and he's been very receptive to that.
Well, as a coaching staff and an organization, you guys have always had a great reputation for getting the most you possibly can out of a pitcher. Now, as long as, Torrey, we're talking about bright futures, Ketel Marte is coming off a season where he hit .329. He had 32 home runs, 92 runs batted in. He was fourth in the MVP voting. He's not yet necessarily a household name around the country, not yet, but for people who are not familiar with him, what are they missing out on him?
Yeah, well, you know, here in the Valley, he has certainly made a name for himself, and he's got a lot of support here. And you're right, I think is on a national level, he's just rising up to match some of those players that are very well known throughout the entire country, such as Mookie Betts and Cody Bellinger and Mike Trout. But for me, he is a very dynamic athlete. He's somebody that can do he can do everything very, very well. He can steal the base to help you win a game. He can make a great play on defense to win a game. But the thing that really elevated last year was the power and the hitability. He's always had good bat-to-ball skills, but he figured out some concepts with our hitting coach. The fundamental really got solidified from both sides of the plate. He had a tremendous year from a power standpoint, but he's a great teammate. He's a good boy. He's a great kid, and he's got a great future ahead of him. He trusts what's going on around here, and I feel like we're going to build around him. And when you're building around guys like that, it gets very powerful.
Talking to Torrey Lovello. Now, Torrey, one of the moves, you were talking about what a great offseason the front office had. One of the moves was the addition of Madison Bumgarner. What's it been like having him part of the team so far?
You know, it's funny. He just walked by my office right now as I was talking to you, and you know, he gave me a wave and a big smile. He's just such a great guy with a huge presence. So when he walks around, you know where he's at inside of the clubhouse. He takes the mound. You've got to take notice as to what he's getting ready to do and how he's going to attack you. He's got 3 World Series rings, so he knows how to win. He's sharing that knowledge day by day with our guys that have been here in that culture that I said is deeply rooted. And then he's teaching the younger guys what it takes to kind of fit into that culture. So we're super excited to have him, the guy, Madison Bumgarner, because he's going to help take us to that next level. He's anchored that number one spot, and everybody's going to fall behind him. But he still has a lot of life in his body. He's going to go out there and compete and win baseball games. That's first and foremost the reason why he was brought in here. We love that he's been what he's been showing us early in camp. He had his first outing four days ago, and it was really good stuff for a first outing. So we're super excited about where he's at right now. We know every fifth day he's going to take that mound and special things could happen.
Torrey, you know he's going to compete. You know he's going to compete on and off the field, allegedly. What was your reaction when you heard the story about Madison allegedly participating in rodeo competitions under an alias?
Yeah, well, it wasn't alleged. We know that it was definitely him. And, you know, I've had ongoing conversations with him throughout the entire time that I've known him. And, you know, at times I'll maybe change the course of that conversation and direct it into, you know, preserving his good health and making sure that he takes care of himself, because he's such an important piece of this organization. He's going to help us get to where we want to get to. And then he's got a lot of baseball games to win. And, you know, I want him to be able to say at the end of the day, when his career is all said and done, that he maximized himself and he won as many baseball games as he possibly could, and he's going to be a Hall of Famer. He's certainly on that road right now. So he, as along with everybody else, I say health is the most important thing. You have responsibilities to take care of yourself on and off the field. So, I kind of shrugged it off and laughed it off, because I'm not going to tell these guys what to do in their own time. I feel like it's a part of his life. I want him to just be careful with whatever he's doing.
Torrey, just one quick thought about that. One quick follow-up. I'm not asking you to tell me what you said to him, but like John Smoltz would say to you, golf prolonged my career. Golf was so healthy for me mentally and physically. I mean, is that maybe what he gets out of that? Is that his golf, or why did he want to do that?
Well, I'm not exactly sure why. I think it's something that's been a part of his blood, in his blood for his whole life. And, you know, once again, I'm not going to make these guys color inside the lines. If they want to color outside of them, that they have all the right to do that. And I believe in that. You know, you see different athletes come from different cultures and playing different sports, and you know, those movements and some of those things that they do, whether their hips or their arms or their bodies move in a certain way, it keeps a certain degree of strength or flexibility inside of their body. So, yeah, I would just make sure that we're adding caution to whatever he's going to be doing. I don't want him to do any cliff diving, you know, let's put it in that form. But I feel like with whatever he can do, he can handle. He's been doing a long time.
Talking to Torrey Lovello, I appreciate your thoughts on that, Torrey, for a couple more moments. You know, it's been a really challenging offseason for baseball. So what kind of thoughts have you had, Torrey, as you watch the Astros cheating scandal unfold?
Yeah, you know, I'm just like every fan. You know, I hated to see that. I felt terrible for the organizations lost their managers or replaced their managers. And, you know, it was just unfortunately a black eye for baseball, and you hate to see something like that happen. And, you know, the game will recover, but we have responsibilities as teams and organizations, and in my case, a manager, to preserve the integrity of this game, and that's what my intentions are. So, like I said, I mean, it was unfortunate. I love a level playing field. That's as far as I want to go with what type of cheating was supposedly happening. But at the end of the day, you know, we're all human beings, and when somebody makes a bad decision or an organization makes a bad decision, you feel for them. And I feel for the guys that lost their jobs.
Torrey Lovello, my guest. Now, Torrey, I want to ask you about your wife, Kristen, really quickly, because she's from Buffalo, and I'm actually, and I know you go way back with this show. We haven't done a tour stop in about a decade and a half, and I'm going to bring at least one back, and it's going to be in Buffalo on April 11th at Shea's Buffalo Theater. I love the city, but I have not been there in a minute or so. Do you get back with Kristen very often?
Oh, my God, I appreciate you giving her some props. She is such a proud Buffalonian, and my entire family, obviously my in-laws, my dad was born and raised in Buffalo, so I have very strong ties to Buffalo. Absolutely. We went back a couple of times this past year. My brother-in-law and sister-in-law just had a newborn, so we went to see him and his family and my mother-in-law. So very strong ties. We are there a couple times every off-season to reconnect with family. So I appreciate you giving some props to the city. It's pretty special.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, I'll tell you how much credit I gave to the city when I brought this thing back, Torrey, for the first time in a decade and a half. We could have gone anywhere. That's the city that we chose. I love Buffalo, and I knew it was time. He is the manager of the D-backs. He is entering his fourth season there. They're coming off an 85-win season. Arizona is at San Francisco today, less than an hour out. Torrey, thanks for making time. It's always great to have you on the show, and I appreciate the relationship after all this time.
Likewise, Romy. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Be good, Torrey. Thank you.
Good night now!